Welcome to Beyond the Uniform, where I interview veterans about their civilian careers. Today is episode number 28 with Graham Plaster.
I think that failure is such a scary word to anybody in a large organization, because generally large organizations like the military or the government, they kind of train you not to discuss failure openly. But in grappling with what you want to do next in life, and kind of coming to grips with who you are, you have to develop much more candor about failure, and you also have to develop resiliency. It helped me to really reflect on, you know, how much sacrifice will I be willing to do in order to achieve what I want to achieve? And how will I talk about my failures, either in the military or in the, you know, civilian workforce, to other people so I can help them?
Although Graham's day job is with the Defense Language and National Security Education Office in Washington, D.C., he keeps his nights and weekends busy. He's the founder of the Intelligence Community, a group with nearly 100,000 members, as well as the author of two books, including Hacking the Job Search. In this interview, we talk a lot about entrepreneurship, about finding a community and identifying ways to deliver value, and about the power of having side projects that give you more energy, and side projects that can potentially give you supplemental income. There are a lot of links in the show notes at beyondtheuniform.io for the podcasts, books, and TED Talks we discuss, so check those out and enjoy my interview with Graham. All right. Well, my guest today is Graham Plaster. Graham, thanks for joining me today.
Yeah, sure.
Quick background on Graham. He is a senior advisor at the Defense Language and National Security Education Office. He started out at the Naval Academy, where he received his bachelor's degree in English, after which he served in the Navy for 11 years as a surface warfare officer, the assistant dean of students at the Naval War College, a United Nations liaison officer, a foreign area officer, and a Navy staff officer for the OPNAV staff. Since his transition to a civilian career, he has worked as a consultant, author, editor, founder, and advisor in a variety of capacities in the Washington, D.C. area. And Graham, I guess just to start off, anything you'd like to add to that background or about your personal life?
No, that's pretty good. I mean, basically, I wear three hats right now. One is, you know, full-time as a policy advisor for Department of Defense, as a defense contractor, actually, for another company. And then I run my own business, which is called the Intelligence Community Incorporated. So I'm an entrepreneur. And then I work for a nonprofit as a volunteer for the Foreign Area Officer Association as the editor-in-chief of their journal, which comes out three times a year. So those are kind of my three hats and that keep me busy. And then at home, I'm also the father of four kids, and we live in an apartment down in Arlington. So it's a lot of life experience to talk about here, and I'm sure that if we can help veterans going through any of the things that I've been through, I'd be happy to do that.
And I'm just taking a stab in the dark here that you do not like to stay idle between the family life and three different hats. I imagine you got a pretty full schedule usually.
Yes. Yeah. It's always a full schedule. That's true.
Well, I always like to start off just with learning more about at what point you knew you were going to leave the military and how you approached that decision.
Yeah, I was off and on with it because I always looked at the Naval Academy and the military as a stepping stone to other things for my career. And yet, once I got into it, like so many other members of the military, I saw that it was a terrific career in and of itself. And so I thought many times that I would be a career officer. But as a foreign area officer, which in the Navy is a very specialized community, and I only did that for about 3.5 years, you really have to be an excellent linguist. And I was learning Arabic, and I was struggling with that. And it got to a point where it was better for me to go ahead and get out and move on to some other things. In this case, you know, working with policy and Department of Defense on culture policy. So I learned a lot through that process. And if I had stayed as a surface warfare officer, I'd probably be deployed right now on a ship doing something out at sea. But as it turned out, my career was, you know, first 7 or 8 years as a surface warfare officer. And then I kind of transitioned to a potentially academic track as the assistant dean of students at the Naval War College, and then I did the FAO work before I got out. And actually, my time at the Pentagon on OPNAV staff was actually as a reservist, because when I was a reservist, I reactivated and did about 5 months working in the Pentagon on the Navy staff.
That was the next thing I was actually going to ask about, is how you thought about reserves. And it sounds like you did choose to do the reserves. What was that experience like?
So the reserves is outstanding. I really, you know, promote the drilling reserves to anybody who's considering it, because once you've left active duty and you're acclimated to the camaraderie and the mission focus of the military, it's hard to go cold turkey directly into the civilian workforce, where oftentimes the culture is different and the mission is different. And so staying in the drilling reserves is a nice middle ground where you still get to keep, you know, put on your uniform once a month and for the weekend. And it's, and generally speaking, what I've encountered is that it's culturally, it's a nice middle ground too, because a lot of the drilling reservists, they all have their full-time jobs. So they understand both worlds, being in the military. So a lot of them were, active duty previously. Some of them come directly into the reserves. And then there tends to be a great professional network there. So if you're looking for your next civilian career, drilling in the reserves is a great way to kind of work your network and look for opportunities.
You know, I never put that together. I mean, I've thought of the reserves as scratching that itch of having the camaraderie that a lot of us enjoyed in the military. But I don't think I ever connected the dots on the professional aspect, where everyone you're drilling with is also has another job, like you said. And so it seems like it could be a really powerful way to meet other people with a similar background who are doing different jobs, and that could lead to a lot of other opportunities. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I would say more so than being active duty, because active duty, you know, everyone you talk to is active duty, and a lot of them, even if they're senior, don't have a strong grasp of what it takes to develop a civilian career. So once you transition to the drilling reserves, you've placed yourself in a pool of people that understand both of your worlds, the military and the civilian career track. So as far as the mentorship aspects of the drilling reserves, it's very, very rich, and it's excellent. And I would recommend any veteran transitioning, you know, and considering drilling reserves, to do that for a couple of years, and also at the same time do American Corporate Partners, ACP. That's an outstanding veteran mentorship program. It's totally free. And it links you up as a veteran with a senior civilian person at a company kind of your choosing, and gives you that ability to potentially get in the door.
That's great. I'll add that to the show notes, a link to American Corporate Partners. But when you interact with them, they just will facilitate that relationship of plugging you in with kind of a civilian mentor who can coach you through applying and just other questions about how to start a civilian career. Is that right?
Right. American Corporate Partners is kind of a best kept secret, I think, for transitioning veterans, because they have been around, I think, for a couple decades, and they basically are run as a pro bono kind of a charitable program out of large, Fortune 500 type companies. Okay. And so if you are an upwardly mobile executive at one of these companies, and you say, what can I do to break out as a leader at, you know, Hewlett Packard or, you know, BlackRock or something like that. And one of the programs available to you is mentor a veteran right out of the military and help them get a job. So then American Corporate Partners does that matchmaking for you. And the veteran who's getting out fills out a profile and says, you know, I'd really like to go into venture capital, or I'd really like to go into sales. And then American Corporate Partners will link you up with a mentor that's successful in that career track, and then has an expectation that you're going to be talking to them regularly for a whole year.
And that's completely free.
Completely free. And they have a online portal, and they have events. Yeah, it's very powerful.
Yeah, that does seem like something every veteran should know about. It can never hurt to have that sort of connection, and to fast track you to forging that bond would be a huge asset.
Yeah. And I always tell veterans, you know, don't give in to the temptation of going on job boards and just spending 80% of your time applying for jobs. You know, spend 80% of your time networking and try to get that, pool from inside the company where you want to go, and get them already knowing you as a known quantity and pulling you in before you start filling out paperwork.
That's great. And one other thing I wanted to ask about before we get into the job search is when you look back on your own transition to civilian life, what was one of the more surprising aspects about that transition or something that you didn't really even know to anticipate?
Well, I think that when you're in the military, you take for granted the fact that there's a career placement person or a detailer basically telling you that your options are, 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, where in the FAOs, it was kind of like one, here's your one option. Yeah. So when you make the transition, it's very difficult to get your mind around the fact that the whole world is your oyster and you can go in any direction. So it's the number of opportunities and options can be overwhelming to veterans. And then also it can be difficult to discipline yourself to stay focused, because if you've been a master of all trades, a jack of all trades, master of none, then if the job market is saying we really need a specialist on this one thing, and you're telling yourself, well, I don't want to lock myself in right now when I could go in so many different directions, it's hard to come up with a very focused resume and then jump right back into a focused track.
Yeah, I agree. And it's something I wanted to dive into more. I mean, you've spent a lot of time looking at the job search process, and I'll include a link in the show notes, but including a book that you wrote called Hacking the Job Search that's available on Amazon. What advice would you give to veterans when approaching their job search?
Well, there's a lot of things, but like I said earlier, I think that the book walks you through kind of 5 steps. It starts with some self-reflection, and you can certainly go through all the career profile tests and things like that. But I think that with a transitioning veteran, it can be a scary transition, and so it's helpful to during, especially during that maybe, a couple months of terminal leave, if you have it, to spend some time, by yourself or with counselors, just really grappling with what you want to do, and think about kind of your Maslow's hierarchy of needs. How much cash you need to live on for a while you figure yourself out, and then for that next kind of phase of your life, once you determine which direction you want to go in, whether you want to go into like a technical field that you haven't had any experience in, or you want to become an entrepreneur or something, then you really need to apprentice yourself to people who are there, and you need to become a learner, And so you need to basically reach out to people that are successful in the field and start to develop a relationship, show that you are coachable and a quick learner, and develop that the camaraderie that you had in the military, develop it with people in that new sector you're trying to get into. Really reach out and show that you're part of this new team. And that can happen through LinkedIn. I do a lot of coaching with people that are trying to learn how to use LinkedIn more effectively. So my ebook talks about how to do kind of like a value proposition to a new contact on LinkedIn, so that they know that you'd be a good person to have in their network, and once you actually get them on the phone or meeting in person, how to really value their time and then leverage that kind of loose tie in order to get in the direction you want to go.
That's great. And just diving in or digging in further on a couple of those points. So you talked about self-knowledge and self-reflection, and it seems to be something that comes up quite a bit in these interviews, is people talking about the importance of really knowing what you want, what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are. And I'm wondering if there's any either tools or resources or approaches that you've used in your own life or seen other veterans use that allow them to deepen that knowledge or to really approach that in a more systematic way.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot, but a great one is podcasts. Your podcast, I'm sure, is excellent and helpful to a lot of people. But I spent a couple of years listening to another veteran podcast called Entrepreneur on Fire with John Lee Dumas.
I listened to
and
that one as well. It is exceptional.
yeah, so I've listened to probably over 1,000 hours of his podcast over the years while I was commuting to and from DC from Annapolis, and that was good therapy for me, because he was a veteran from our year group, an Army veteran, and he made the transition and is doing very well as an entrepreneur. And he interviews an entrepreneur every day. I mean, he records them all at once and then puts them out every day. And one of the questions that in that interview, which is so powerful, especially for veterans, is describe one of your greatest failures and how you basically overcame it. I think that failure is such a scary word to anybody in a large organization, because generally large organizations like the military or the government, they kind of train you not to discuss failure openly. But in grappling with what you want to do next in life and kind of coming to grips with who you are, you have to become, you have to develop much more candor about failure, and you also have to develop resiliency. And so listening to, like I said, about 1,000 hours of that podcast and all the different people who have had massive failures and bounce back and become better because of them, it helped me to really reflect on, you know, how much sacrifice will I be willing to do in order to achieve what I want to achieve? And how will I talk about my failures, either in the military or in the, you know, civilian workforce, to other people so I can help them?
That's great. I mean, yeah, you're right. The biggest learnings we have often come from those most painful moments and those failures. And that's a very rich source to delve into to uncover more about who we are and what makes us tick. And I love that thought, too. I think one thing, especially for people listening that are considering entrepreneurship, one reason I would really recommend Entrepreneur on Fire, EO Fire, is because there's these daily interviews with different entrepreneurs. You get such a good sense of all the different entrepreneurial paths, what life looks like, and what people's different approaches have been, which could, you know, complete the picture for you on knowing if that's something you want to do or how you might go about it. And I'm wondering, Graham, if there's any other podcasts or sites that you would recommend for people trying to do that research to uncover what else is out there.
Well, for entrepreneurial stuff, I listen to This Week in Startups, Jason Calacanis. I find that to be very high energy and cutting edge. You know, interviewing a lot of forward leaning technologists in Silicon Valley, also, A16Z, which is the Anderson Horowitz podcast, is also very forward-leaning. Anderson Horowitz being a big, you know, venture capital firm that is behind a lot of the social media companies like Facebook and others. So A16Z and Twist, you know, This Week in Startups are great. And then also one of my favorites, one that I listen to relax, is 99% Invisible with Roman Mars. So that one is all about design, but I find it to be such a well-done podcast that I would prefer to listen to that over most radio talk show on NPR and stuff. So I always download it and listen to it to kind of like escape and refocus.
That's great. I mean, it's an exciting time for someone to be making that transition because there are so many free online, readily available, high quality resources to give you a sense for what else is out there and to deepen your knowledge once you know you want to do something. And, yeah, I appreciate that. Another thing I wanted to dive into is you talked about coaching people through LinkedIn and how to use that to, make connections and get time with someone. I'm wondering, what are some common mistakes that you see veterans make when it comes to LinkedIn or when it comes to basic networking?
Sure. Well, first of all, just a preface, like the business that I run, the Intelligence Community Inc., it grew out of a LinkedIn group called the Intelligence Community. So I run social networks currently that have a reach of over 100,000 people. And so our largest LinkedIn group is called the Intelligence Community with about 66,000 people. It grows at about 1,000 new members a month. And I have personally reviewed thousands of LinkedIn profiles and given lectures on, you know, how to leverage social media and stuff for defense or diplomacy. So we could talk about this topic for days. But how veterans don't use LinkedIn or should use LinkedIn, bottom line is they should use LinkedIn. They should use it carefully. They should use it professionally. They should get in there early because it is basically the future of the resume. And and what I'm seeing is that there's a lot of late bloomers. Generally speaking, once a military person commits to getting into the LinkedIn platform and leveraging it, they do it very effectively and very well. But what that takes is the same discipline that you'd put into a resume. The difference is with LinkedIn, it's kind of, I'm currently, and I don't know if this will be the truth in the future, but it's currently operating on kind of an old model for search engine optimization. So a well-constructed LinkedIn profile will have a lot of keyword loading where you actually build a whole lot of blocks of experience. You don't necessarily create a block for each job. You might create a block on your LinkedIn profile for each task that you've done and let it be kind of a long scrolling LinkedIn profile. And then each one you need to pack with keywords for specific jobs that you're interested in and specialties. And then once you've done that, because you're optimizing it for search on LinkedIn, then you want to build your network as large and as specific as possible. So, you know, you want it big and you want it good. So it's not one or the other. You don't want to be like a LinkedIn open networker or these lions that basically are indiscriminate and connect with everybody. You really want to connect with as many people that are of high quality in your desired specialty as possible. Because once you've connected with them, then it's much easier on LinkedIn to, you know, send them a message and either take them out for coffee or a beer or have a phone call. So, of course, if you are a veteran on LinkedIn, you can take advantage of the free premium account, which is just offered to veterans. And that's a terrific opportunity if you use it. A lot of people who are veterans contact me and they say, you know, should I get the free premium account? I said, absolutely. And they're like, well, what do I do with it? I said, well, if you don't have a lot of connections on LinkedIn, you can leverage the in-mails, which are allow you to send a direct message to someone who's not a connection. But you don't want to do that in a way that comes across as spam. So if you're going to do that, you need to make sure it's a well-crafted personal note and it has some sort of value proposition where you say to somebody, I'm a transitioning veteran, I'm looking for a job in your sector, and I was wondering if maybe I could get, you know, buy you a beer and ask you a couple questions or have a 10-minute phone call and just get a little bit of insight about, you know, how to get in the door. And, you know, one of the things that I recommend to people if they want to create kind of, like I said, the value proposition is maybe write an article for a professional journal that is of interest to that person and say to the person, hey, I'm thinking about working my way into that career track. Could I interview you for a profile? And I'm going to be submitting it to this trade publication that's in your sector. So that gives you a good kind of offering to buy their time. But there's also a site called Purple Squirrel. It's brand new. And it literally allows you to buy by the hour time of a person working at an industry that you want to get into. So you can actually pay $30 an hour or something to talk to a sales professional at Google so that you can get to know them and get to know what the career is like.
This is great. I mean, I love so much of what you're saying. I think one of the things that jumps out at me is going back to what you said at the very start, where a lot of veterans are jack of all trade, masters of none, and the advantage to starting to narrow in on a specific area of focus. And it sounds like that also helps then in being able to really customize your LinkedIn profile, your LinkedIn network and your outreach, and you're able to go so much deeper, so much faster. And, I think that was worth pointing out. And I love what you said too about, you know, offering, showing someone that you value their time, offering to buy them coffee, offering to buy them beer. That does help in at least showing as a token that you appreciate their time and you're willing to give something in return for that, even if it is just a $6 beer. And right. I really like that idea of, it's a very clever approach of using the interview. So first, someone who is harder to get a hold of, doing that interview, it does then provide value to them and saying like, look, you can get some publicity out of this. So I'm interviewing you. It makes you a little bit more credible in that outreach.
Right.
And I hadn't heard of Purple Squirrel, but I'll add a link to that in the show notes as well. And it sounds like, you know, it does seem like most veterans are willing to take calls from other veterans, but for something that's harder to get a hold of, it might be worth looking at Purple Squirrel and you know, maybe buying that time with someone to get a deep dive in a particular area.
Yeah, and the price point's relatively low from what I've seen. I mean, CIA has a presence in Purple Squirrel, which is interesting to think that you could actually rent time with a CIA recruiter. The job seeker events that I host around DC, I make it free for recruiters to come and I charge the job seekers a cover charge. And so what that means is we get a lot more recruiters and we get serious job seekers, and then we'll have, you know, some beer and some food, and we'll let them network with each other. And over the course of the evening, a lot of strong connections are made. And generally that comes out of having that casual rapport building environment where it's not necessarily like a job fair. Job fairs, typically you have, you know, long lines of people with stacks of resumes waiting to talk to just one or two recruiters. So I think whatever you can do as a job seeker to increase your surface area of exposure to CXOs and recruiters, that's what you should be doing.
That's great. And let's talk about the intelligencecommunity.com. And you started to talk about how this came out of a LinkedIn group, but I'd love to learn more about what led to you founding the intelligence community and what that process was like of bringing this new organization to life.
So I was working on a master's degree in, I guess, 2009, 2010, and I was really interested in comparative literature. And specifically, I got more focused on emerging literary forms like social media, like maybe like the tweet as a literary form, or the blog post. And I was studying Iranian blogging for my master's thesis. And that kind of, it just developed a passion in me for kind of the philosophical underpinnings of what was going on in social media and some of the, anthropological phenomena that we're seeing. And one of the things I saw happening was a lot of organic groups springing up out of market demand. So for instance, NPR, National Public Radio, decided they wanted to create a Facebook group for, you know, for their company. And they went on Facebook and realized that there was already an unofficial NPR Facebook group with like 10,000 followers. And this is back in like 2009 or something. And they had a conundrum because they didn't want to start the official NPR Facebook group and just have a couple hundred people and have the unofficial one be the really successful one that everybody was following and joining. And so what they did was they basically did a soft takeover where they approached the guy that was running it and said, how would you like to be the official NPR Facebook group? And they deputized him. And he was so happy because he'd been doing all this work for free and didn't have any official recognition. And, it was like he won the lottery. So I realized that social media was giving, platforms to all these organic and unofficial groups, and that there was an opportunity for a merger. There were opportunities for marrying up official institutions with unofficial groups and gatherings online. And that many of the institutional groups like trade associations or certainly the government, the intelligence community, the DOD, they were anathema to deputizing someone who was not in their organization. They were not interested probably in going out and finding a volunteer outside their organization to run any type of PR, piece for their organization. So when I was on active duty and I saw that the LinkedIn group called the intelligence community was already 13,000 members. And at the time I'd been personally requested to be the aide-de-camp to the up and coming, director of DIA, who's, General Mike Flynn. And, so I made an approach to the LinkedIn group and I said, how about I help you manage this group? I might be in a position in the intelligence community to really leverage it in service to the U.S. intelligence community and defense, departments. And so I did basically the merger that I'm proposing that a lot of people should be able to do. And over time, I cultivated that group and basically made it more and more official by holding live events. And then over time, once I got out of the military, we took that group and we incorporated it as an LLC, and then now it's a C corp. And what we do is we use that group as a community. So we put community back in the intelligence community. Is what we'd like to say. And we through hosting live events and putting together information products, we try to help each other, and we operate kind of as a pseudo trade association or as a pseudo media outlet. And I'm kind of the face to that group. And then I'm also, I don't know if I mentioned it to you, I'm also launching a podcast. So it's going to be focused primarily on defense and intelligence innovation. So I'll be interviewing different people that have innovative ideas and programs that are in kind of the ecosystem around defense and intelligence.
That's great. And when you send the link to the podcast, I'll add that to the show notes so people great. Listening can find that. I'm you know, one thing I'm very intrigued by this whole process is, especially for those considering entrepreneurship, and this is again why I think EO Fire is such a great podcast. There is such a value to finding a different community that you're passionate about and just taking the plunge. And there's so much value that you can provide to even something that might seem like a niche community. And I've seen this with entrepreneurs in the world of paleo or in the world of just very specific things. And there's a great article I'll link to in the show notes about 1,000 true fans. And the premise of the article is like, in today's connected world, all you need to really start a thriving business is you need 1,000 people who really care about whatever you're doing. You don't need 100,000 people to start with. You just need 1,000 passionate people. And what it sounds like Graham has done is, you know, he has now grown to something that's very large, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. But it started at something that a lot of people, myself, and, you know, I'll be honest, when I heard about it, it's like, okay, the intelligence community, how many people does that include? And then you step back and you start to think about it and you're like, you know, actually, a lot. And not only is there a lot of people there, but as Graham is talking about this, you can see all the different ways in which he's found to provide value. And it sounds like that's in-person conferences. It sounds like that's online discussion. It sounds like that's ebooks. It sounds like that's now podcasts. And as you take that deep dive, you start to see all the different ways in which you can add value to a community. And you know, one of the things I was curious to learn about with this is what does this translate to you for you on a day-to-day basis? Like, what does your involvement with the intelligence community look like from one day to another?
Well, my day job, which is as a policy advisor, is an eight to nine hour a day job. Unfortunately, I don't do any work on the weekends through that. But, you know, my work for the Intelligence Community Incorporated has to take place in nights and weekends. So it's totally, it keeps me definitely working, you know, around the clock. And, you know, my long-term dream is that my own business would be self-sustaining, and it hasn't, you know, it's taken me a few years to get kind of thing to the point where we're making money, and we are making money as a company, but we're not making enough money to employ me as full-time. So the day-to-day grind is very much, you know, get up relatively early, go and do my work for the government, come home, you know, do time with the kids, get back on the computer in the evenings and do more work, you know. So it's just, I was kind of built for that because I was a surface warfare officer, you know, in the Navy. So I feel comfortable working like that. But it does make for a good joke once in a while. People say, how are you doing all that?
You know, but I think that this is so representative where most companies are not started overnight. And, most companies, in my opinion, are similar to what Graham is describing, where it is the passion of nights and weekends. And it often takes multiple years to get to the point where it is generating revenue to support you full time. And so I think for those listening that are interested in this, this is something you can do while on active duty. This is something you can do while working at another job. And another book I'll link to in the show notes is a book by Elizabeth Gilbert called Big Magic. It is such an incredible book. And she wrote this mainly for artists and creative types, but I think the parallels to entrepreneurship are so powerful. And one of the things she talks about in her book is not putting too much pressure on your inspiration. And she talks about authors who want to quit their full-time job to work on their book. And she always cautions that, you know, this was the author who wrote Eat, Pray, Love, which was fantastically successful. Right. And she talks about even after that book, she was still working another job. She never wanted to ask too much of her inspiration to also support her financially. And so I think that Graham's a great example here of someone who is working, you know, a couple irons in the fire and working away and over time building those things up, but not asking that, you know, from day one, the intelligence community is enough to support him and his family full time. And I think that that's a common entrepreneurial story of being able to do a couple different things to pay the bills and working on something on the side to grow it to potentially support you.
That's right. And there's a lot to admire in anybody who has hustle. It's something that, you know, I want my kids to learn from seeing me. It's something that, you know, I admire about my wife and how much she is doing to support me and how much work she does. So, you know, nothing comes easy. That's worthwhile. You have to work at it. You have to get it the hard way. But that's the whole value of the self-reflection piece at the beginning. When you say, this is what I really want, this is where I want to go. And then you count the costs and you go after it and you fail and then you try again and you fail and you try again. That's what builds character and that's what makes you the person that's worth looking up to in the end. Mm. And so entrepreneurship is a great adventure. In America, we have that freedom to pursue happiness in a way that is just really special and amazing. And I think that veterans make great entrepreneurs because we have that work ethic and we are jacks of all trades, which is an important kind of agility to take into the entrepreneurial world. But one of the things we also have to work on is the ability to admit to failure and talk about failure and overcome failure. Because, you know, when you're coming from a ship where it's like maybe you want to have this kind of zero defect mentality where everything's always ship shape and perfect and your uniform's squared away, it becomes difficult to talk openly about your struggles.
Oh, I wholeheartedly agree. And what I really appreciate in the candor of what you're saying is, you know, two things I believe as well, which is hard work makes up for a lot. I think that's one strength that most veterans have is the ability to just break through walls, but realizing that everything worthwhile, at least in my experience, comes through a tremendous amount of effort and hard work and hustle and late nights and long weekends. And so recognizing that these things don't just happen, or that quote, the harder I work, the luckier I am. There's a tremendous amount of hard work to get to where you want to go. And then that second piece around failure as well. And I think this is true in every career, but especially entrepreneurship, that almost every great learning is born from horribly messy and often public failures that are painful and leave scars, but they teach you the skills you need to ultimately succeed and to not shy away from those failures. I think that in the military, failure can be associated with tremendous loss of life or of a ship or something like that. And and that is something to be aware of in that transition of not letting that make you risk averse or failure averse, because it is so necessary in the civilian world for success.
Yeah, there's a story, and I might not get it perfectly correct, so maybe a listener will be able to correct it, but I think it was Nimitz that, as a junior officer, actually ran a ship aground. And, he was given a second chance and went on to become, an incredibly successful leader. And then when I was at the Naval War College, I heard a story about a corpsman, a hospital corpsman, who got to take care of Nimitz in his old age and was carrying Nimitz through like a VA hospital or something on a gurney. And actually dropped Nimitz on the ground. Like, he rolled off the gurney onto the ground. And that corpsman was basically demoted, from his job. And I thought it was a great irony that Nimitz himself had run a ship aground and been able to be forgiven. But a corpsman ran Nimitz aground and didn't get a second chance.
Oh, man. One question I had on the intelligence community was, any other advice you have for a veteran who's thinking of starting their own organization or their own company?
Well, I would say basically give yourself a free MBA by listening to 1,000 hours of Entrepreneur on Fire. Cause you can do that while you're on terminal leave. You can, while you're working out in the morning, start listening to all of these interviews with entrepreneurs and, really get, a wide, sense of, what the entrepreneurial profile looks like. Get a good sense of what that means when John Lee Dumas talks about the baby effect, which is when you have a kid or, dependents that are depending on you and you want to be an entrepreneur, it puts your back against the wall and you're in a sink or swim situation. So that's something that a lot of entrepreneurs, a lot of veterans don't think about, because if they are transitioning at the 20-year point and they have their retirement to fall back on, then generally they have a cushion Whereas I advise a lot of them, if they don't have a cushion, like jump right into your 9/11 GI Bill so you can get your BAH kind of flowing and you have some cushion. But generally speaking, what drives an entrepreneur to succeed is desperation, where you say, I have to succeed because I have no other options. And if you have any kind of cushion or any kind of safety net, it can be one of the things that holds you back from going as hard as you need to go in order to succeed.
Mm, that's great. And another thing I wanted to ask about, so you talked at the start about the three different hats that you wear, and in looking at your background and LinkedIn profile, you have three primary hats, but you've also had lots of other hats like author and contributing writer and just a really broad variety of activities. And I'm wondering, for someone, a veteran who wants to do the same, they want to be able to work on multiple things simultaneously, what advice do you have for them about how to make that work or how to juggle effectively across multiple things?
Well, I mean, it really depends on your personality, because some people are, thrive on multitasking, like ADD type of people, like to have a lot of things going on all at once. And other people have to shut everything down and focus. And I tend to be a little bit more on the multitasking side, but it has been destructive over the years to want to do a lot of things all at once. I tend to get in a car nowadays and my wife says, now, where are you trying to drive to? And I'll say, I have no clue. Or if somebody says, what happened yesterday? I'll say, I have no recollection of what happened yesterday.
That also sounds like an intelligence trick. That seems like a tactic to avoid being interrogated, where you can't remember whatever you're going to do. Anyways.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. But I can tell you what it typically is when you have you're overloading with the RAM or something. You have too many operations running on your phone or your computer, and things start to slow down. In that environment, you have to ask yourself an honest question and say, are the activities that I'm engaged in the right ones? Do I need to prune? Do I need to, come back to just a few things that I'm really passionate about? And in some cases, you have to dig in and do all of them for a short amount of time because they are all important. And you have to do a little recovery afterwards where you take a vacation or you get some counseling or whatever, And the other part of it is that, the activities you do, some of them give you energy and some of them take energy. So for me, I was an English major and I didn't get to do a lot of high quality writing, during my first couple of years as a JO. But once the book project came along, In the Shadow of Greatness, which people can see in my LinkedIn profile, and I know you know about it, that was an outlet for me that gave me energy and I enjoyed it. And it gave me energy to take back to my other day job in other side projects that were more taxing. So in some cases, work is life-giving, and in some cases it's a grind. And people have to have a self-awareness about which parts are helping them to thrive and which parts are just paying the bills. And it's okay to have both, I think. It's okay to have a job that is just the grind that pays the bills, and then doing some other things that pay less or don't pay at all that you really enjoy and give you a sense of purpose and a sense of, joy.
That's great. It makes me think of a while back, I talked to one of the members of our board of directors, and at the time, I had only been working on Storybox exclusively for a very long time, and it had broached the subject with him of starting to work on a couple of ideas on the side, and his response was very enthusiastic and echoed what Graham just said of there are ways in which when you work on something else, it gives you more energy. You might think that working on two projects would have a net deficit on your energy, but in so many ways, it can cause you to look at things from a different perspective, or you're learning in a way that you haven't done, or it's like flexing a muscle that is atrophied over time. And so in many ways, these side projects can become a source of energy and a source of inspiration that actually helps your main job or your main focus. And so I really enjoyed that about what you had said.
Yeah. And I think what Google and some other companies have tried to do, this whole 20% time thing, and try to introduce systematically some sort of creative outlet time into the day. I think from my Naval Academy years, I remember discussing the concept of leisure. And I think it was Greek tragedy class that we were talking about, leisure being something which is not the same as I don't know, the other concept, which is this checking out, right? Leisure being something which is active. It might be relaxing, but it's active, and it maybe it helps your brain to develop. It helps your skills to develop. It helps you become a better person.
As opposed to something passive like TV or something where you're just completely checked
TV's,
out.
Yeah, TV's probably the best example, or, you know, certain aspects. And I was part of a discussion a couple years ago about, you know, are we in a better place or worse place now with technology being, you know, everyone's addicted to screens. And someone made a good point, and I tend to agree with it, that, you know, we growing up in Gen X, Gen Y, had screens that were one directional, just watching TV and, you know, sitting in front of the boob tube, right? And then now we're in a place where it's much more interactive. So as much as we critique social media or, you know, everybody having a phone in their hands, it actually still is more human than it was when we were experiencing it as a kid, where it was just like feeding us information out of, you know, the screen. And so there is a case to be made for both putting your devices down, turning the screens off, but also there is one for, if you're going to do it in a way that's connected, that's human, that's helping you to become a better human. And so back, you know, full circle to what I was saying about leisure, like when you're relaxing your brain, do it in a way that makes you a better human being. And for me, like, I've gone through phases, you know, long rides on metros and buses to get to work and everything, where I was playing a lot of Angry Birds or Words with Friends. And there was this balance where I was like, okay, I'm definitely atrophying my brain right now. I'm not helping myself at all. This is not relaxing me. And then other times where it was totally the thing that dropped my, you know, dropped my, my pulse and got me like focused and allowed me to like kind of escape some of the multitasking pressures that had built up, so I could come back to it and hit it hard an hour later, you know?
That's great. That's great. And I know we're running short on time, but I did want to dive a little bit into your day job at Defense Language and National Security Education Office. And I haven't spoken with someone with that particular industry focus so far, and would just love to learn, especially for someone listening on active duty, how would you explain your main day job, and what does your day-to-day look like?
Well, the Defense Language National Security Education Office is a policy office underneath the Undersecretary of Defense for Readiness. So readiness is kind of a military term for getting ready to do anything, whether it's, you know, be ready for smallpox and the flu outbreaks, or be ready to speak other languages. When you think about the capacity of the military to do certain things and fight wars and do you know, stability operations or whatever in another country, you have to consider what it takes to get them ready to do those things. So readiness, policy for readiness, is all about kind of building the muscles of the programs and the capacity of the military. So in our office, we focus on language and culture and regional expertise readiness. And I'm specifically the senior advisor for cultural readiness. And that's coming from my foreign area officer experiences, and also being the editor in chief of the FAO Association Journal. And then I do some content management for a website called cultureready.org, which I help to build for the government, and I help maintain it. And so what we do is we look at programs across the government that are about cultural training for the Department of Defense, but also the government at large. That's a very large topic, and because culture is not just about working alongside Afghan and Iraqi forces, it's also about how you acclimate a military person as they leave the military and go work in the civilian workforce, or how you work alongside other governmental cultures like State Department or Peace Corps or something like that. So there's cultural readiness is an interesting topic, and we could definitely dig into that if you want to. But my day to day is I show up, you know, around 8 a.m, leave around 5 p.m, and do a lot of meetings throughout the day. I push a lot of paper around, policy documents, so that I get to take a chop on them and give some advice on how I think things should shape. I take some trips to conferences that are kind of academic in nature, or I meet with different offices within the military around the country, and spend my time meeting with people and talking about ideas.
That's great. That's great. Well, we've covered a lot here, and I know this has been valuable for me, and I know it will be valuable for our listeners as well. I guess in closing, I would just ask, is there any other advice you would want to give to veterans listening, or anything that you wish you had known at the time of separation, or any final words of wisdom that we didn't touch on already that you'd like to share?
One thing that came to mind that I didn't mention before is, as you are looking to, as a veteran is looking to figure out their specialty, one of the tricks that I mentioned in my book, Hacking the Job Search, which comes from a TED lecture, and I don't have the name of the TED lecture speaker offhand, but you can find it, is a lot of people specialize in one thing, and it's difficult to be the best at one thing. But if you can think of two things in your life that you're really good at, or passionate about, you know, and find the intersection of those two things, at the intersection of those two things might be a very unique specialty for you to focus on. So, you can just think, you know, kind of mathematically about, you know, discovering your specialty. Just think about the two things that you're passionate about, intersect those two things. And at the intersection, you have something you can work with, you know, to pitch yourself. And that can help some people with kind of writer's block on how to overcome that whole problem of being a jack of all trades, master of none.
To make it concrete for yourself, what are two of those areas that when you're doing that exercise, what would you say were those two areas that intersected for you?
You know, generally I say social media and diplomacy, or social media and intelligence, are the two kind of general areas. It would be very hard for me to be the best person in the world at social media, or the best person in the world at, you know, diplomacy or intelligence. But crossing those two streams gives me something unique to talk about, and you know, specializes me. So it's just kind of a trick to help people kind of get in the right mindset to, you know, work on their resume or their LinkedIn profile and get more specialized.
Awesome. Well, this is great. I'll include the links to all the things we talked about, including your books, In the Shadow of Greatness, as well as Hacking the Job Search. I'll also track down that TED Talk on Hacking the Job Search and put a link there as well. But Graham, thanks for your time, and always good to reconnect.
You too, Justin.
Thanks for listening. Three quick announcements. First, if you're enjoying this podcast, it would mean a lot if you take a few minutes to leave a review on iTunes. It helps me get this work further out to the veteran community. Second, based on my interviews, I'd advise any and all veterans to look at servicetoschool.org and the American Corporate Partners. Both are completely free for veterans and give you a lot of great resources for your education or professional life, respectively. Third, there are a ton of other great interviews, resources, and data at beyondtheuniform.io. Check it out, share it with your friends, and drop me a line if you have any feedback. I'd love to hear from you. Thanks, and see you on the next interview.